Hello and welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. As always, I am your host, Don Komarechka, here in Barrie, Ontario. And with me is my guest host today.
Oh, that's where I come in, Alan Attridge. How are you, Don?
I am great. I'm stealing your intro. Alan is the host of the Two Hosers Photo Show, of which I'm an occasional guest on and an avid listener of. And your intro doesn't ever change. Every time I tune in, it's always the exact same words. Ever think about switching that up a little bit?
No, I like the consistency of it. We have a very distinct format. Always start with the cold open, which I happen to love. I love that in TV episodes, especially that where maybe the intro has nothing to do with the show, and that which is what we've done for coming up on 400 episodes. We've done the cold open every single time.
You say you have a good format, and yes, the cold open, and then similar words like we just said, and then it's off the rails.
Yes, I didn't say we had a good format. We have a distinct format. Whether it's good or not, that's up to you. But there's certain things that I like. I like opening with that line. So I bookend the show very consistently. So I think since the very, very first episode, we've said the exact same thing. And then we end off with the same tagline every week. But in between, anything goes.
Exactly. And I've been on that roller coaster ride. How many times have I been on your show? 5 or 6 times, I think.
I've lost track. Is it that low? I thought I would have guessed higher, 8 or 9, but we'll get that number up starting.
We should. Well, what's new and exciting with you, Alan? I hear you have a new camera.
I do have a new camera. Well, it's an old new camera.
New to you.
New to me. Yeah, my 5D Mark II is finally seeing its end of life. It's just been misbehaving lately, and I couldn't figure it out. Like, I would snap a photo, and the red light, like, it just would not process the image. And I thought, oh no. And it was intermittent, and then it would kind of come and go. And I noticed on the LCD screen there's some black lines, and I thought, oh no, is that in the image? But it's not. The image is fine. It's just the readout. And so I thought, oh man, what's going on?
Interesting that it's more solid state components that are failing rather than the mechanical things like the shutter or the mirror mechanism.
Right. And I talked to our mutual friend, Chris Marquardt, and he said he figured it sounded a lot like it could be corrosion, which is possible. I mean, I do baby that camera. I don't take it out in the ocean like I do my other cameras. But, I have had it for, when did the 5D Mark II come out? It's got to be close to 8
That years. Was in December of 2008.
Okay, so I bought it. I would have bought it about a year after that, year and a half after that. So I've had it 8-9 years. Kind of hard to cry about it going down now.
Yeah, yeah. And so. I got that camera. I pre-ordered it, and so I got it. That's how I remember the date that it was released, or at least the date that I got my pre-order in. And I had so much fun with that camera. And some of my best, most iconic work was taken with it. And then when I upgraded, I converted it to an infrared camera, and I still have it today. Mm-hmm. It's a workhorse. It has always been. And of course, it was famous for shooting video, one of the first very good DSLR/video kind of hybrid cameras. And I know that's been your bailiwick for quite some time, too.
That's why I bought the camera. And that's what I was using it for primarily. And so I had a job coming up. It's about 3 weeks ago, I guess. I was going over to England to go and shoot at the Goodwood Festival of Speed. Again, I've shot there a couple times, and I knew that my camera was still technically working. I knew it would work on the way there, at least. What I didn't want to be is out there shooting, and it just dies.
Right.
And so we're over there. Like, I knew I'd be interviewing WWE superstar Goldberg, for example. And I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of him.
Fair enough. Well, and you also have to think, too, it's a great camera. You've gotten your mileage out of it. It's not really worth anything now in its current state. I mean, I don't think you could turn around and sell it to anybody for anything.
No, it's a paperweight. And so the bottom line was I needed a new camera, and that was fine. I don't mind. I recognize that every so often you got to refresh and get the updated camera. But I wasn't in love with the Mark IV, the 5D Mark IV.
Well, they didn't do a whole lot to appeal to my senses anyhow from the Mark III. I mean, yes, it's better, but so marginally so that if you are looking to get something on a used market, which you can get a 5D Mark IV used too, but the cost difference is hard to justify if you're looking at the two of them side by side.
And that's where I found myself. Now, out in small town Germany, out in the woods where I live, tracking down a used camera, there is no Craigslist, for example. And so it's difficult to find a used camera out here. So I was resigned to the fact that, okay, I'm going to be looking at the Mark IV. I'm going to buy it new. The price is way too high, in my opinion, for what you get. And so, but I said, you know, hey, I'm kind of under the gun here. I got to leave. It'll leave for England in 2 days. What do I do? So I went into the store, went in and told the guy, okay, I'll take one. He says, okay, we have one in stock. He couldn't find it. And so, you know, he said, oh, do you want to buy the one in the window, you know, at full price? And of course you don't, you know, it's been manhandled. And, so I said, okay, well, I'll go to this other place. I'll go to the big box store and see what they have. And when I was there, the guy said, no, we don't have those, but let me show you the Sony A7 III.
And, right. And it's a beautiful camera in its own right.
Yes. And I was close to pulling the trigger on that. So now I had all these, you know, these things going around in my head. What do I do? What do I do? And ultimately I didn't want to switch horses, you know, in the middle of this stream. I don't mind a different stream down the road, but, and it was a really cool camera, a lot to like about it, but I didn't want to just do an up and change, even though you can get the adapter for the lenses. And I hear good things about the conversion. I just didn't want to do it. So I luckily, just by complete fluke, found a used Mark III in my area, like 20-minute drive from my house, which is very, very close for where I live. And I went out and saw it. I said, okay, well, if it's halfway decent, I'll make this guy an offer. And it was brand new. He said he had like 10,000 shots on it.
It was probably handled less than the one in the store window.
I would very much so. Yep. And this guy was great. I mean, the picture is on our version of Craigslist, which is very, very small. Basically, you know, I look for certain things, like if someone posts a picture of their used camera, if it's got, you know, no lens on it and no cap and sitting on a carpet, that's a red flag.
Yeah, or if it's got some, you know, cracks in the casing or severe sort of brassing on all the sides, it's like, you know, this camera looks like it was, you know, put through a rock tumbler.
Right. And I don't mind picking that up, but at a much, you know, bigger discount. And so anyways, this thing was brand new. He kept it in a cupboard out of the sunlight. He advertised he's a non-smoker, no pets. And so I saw the camera and it's like, okay, yeah, I'm taking this. And so now I'm the proud owner of a new old 5D Mark III.
Well, and you know, one of the reasons why I sort of brought up, of course, the 5D Mark II and everything, and you use that to record a lot of video. I was talking on the last episode with Chris Marquardt, who is the guest host, and we happened across a discussion about the Invisible Camera project that he was into, and he dropped a little hint that it wasn't his idea, but it was your idea. And I'm so curious as to where this concept of pulling the wool over everybody's face came from.
Wow. So that was about almost 8 years ago now, I think, coming up 7.5 years ago. I can't believe that. But I was working with, I had just met Chris. It turns out, like, I live in a town called Tubingen. My wife had Googled, we just moved there. My wife had Googled Tubingen photographers, basically to find me a friend, I think. She was kind of tired of me hanging around the house. And so his name came up in tips from the top floor. And I said, that sounds familiar. And as it turned out, so I got in touch and said, hey, you know, you want to meet? And it turns out his studio was like a 3-minute walk from my house. Like, it was right in the same little neighborhood, which I couldn't believe.
It's awesome.
So we went and we met for coffee, and about 2 minutes into that meeting, he just said, hey, do you want to be on my show? And I'd never been on a podcast. I'd heard a couple of podcasts before, but I'd never been on one. And so I thought, yeah, that sounds great. So I went up to his studio. We did a podcast. And then like a week later, or a couple of weeks later, we were working on something else. And I saw the Marquardt International Pinhole, which is that what that's there. It is there. I see it. I saw the prototype that he had built for that. And he explained to me exactly what it was. And then just something went off in my head. And I said, we have to make a clear one and to promote this for you, but make it for April Fools. And so this is sometime in March or something like that, or end of February. I said, let's just do that. Let's just have some fun. We'll make it and see what happens. And so he thought it was a great idea. So he went and I think for about $40, he had somebody whip up a like a Lexan version of the Marquardt International pinhole. And that was it. We set off. And so we sat down one day in a studio with no script and just kind of riffed. And I got home, looked at the footage, and it was terrible. Like, not funny. It was, there's no story there. And I thought, no, this we can't do this. So I went and sat down at the computer, and I then wrote a script of what this was going to be.
And it wasn't just Chris either. I mean, you had other quote-unquote professionals and experts that were being interviewed as well as part of this project to add a very strong layer of credibility to it.
Well, they were actors, but yes.
Well, sure. But at the end of the day, that I think is what sealed the deal and convinced a lot of people that this could possibly be a thing.
Right. And so, yeah, so we sat down the second time and we went through it and I gave Chris the script, which he loosely followed. And then we would improv. If I thought of something funny, I would just stand off camera and give him a line and feed him a line to say. And then this narrative took shape and I started just sort of making stuff up. Like I made up, I thought if you're going to tell a lie and you use specifics, it kind of sells the lie better. So I thought of something like, oh, we'll bring in Jacques Cousteau into this. Unbeknownst to me, he had some similar kind of idea project. I forget what it was called. A number of the viewers emailed us, hey, is this like his tiger eye or something like that, or shark's eye or something like that? I said, oh, I complete guess on my part. I had no clue that he had anything to do with this. It was just all these lies. but we had fun with it. And then it was my first introduction to what Twitter was, because Chris had developed a pretty decent following.
And so he got a lot of attention once this video went out. And as we were discussing last week, you guys had to pull it down quicker than you expected, because the response, the genuine interest from the really well-educated community, we're talking scientists and people in the cinema world, and yeah, they wanted to get their hands on one of these to test, and I think that was a wonderful moment for you, mission accomplished, but job too well done. I think
it was interesting, and I had a few of my friends who were really really angry at me because I didn't tell anybody, and so some of my friends, guys I went to film school with, they had told all their friends, at the TV stations they work at, and so they look kind of silly on Monday morning, but and they were angry at me. And I felt bad for Chris. I said, before we release this, I said, you're likely to get a lot of hate mail. And I don't want you to lose listeners over this. And he said, nah, he was going to risk it. And he did. He did lose a few listeners, he said. But
know at least one person that is bitter about it.
is it you?
No, it is not me. Although I was genuinely fooled as well. And when it was all revealed, I was like, yeah, too good to be true. You guys sold it really well. And it was such fun, which led me to buy a Marquardt International pinhole. So
see, that was the whole mission, was to get the word out for that. And then exactly 1 year later, I believe it was 1 year to the day, Lytro announced their first camera, that's the focus shifting.
The lipstick shaped one, right?
Right. And so there was a lot of, is this the invisible camera part two? And and we were saying, no, nothing to do with us. This is not us at all.
Oh, that's fun. Well, thanks for filling in some of the gaps on that story, especially because it is a relatively slow news week. I do have some fun stuff to talk about. And I'm glad that I've got you on as a cinema guy to talk about some of the possibilities with our first story. And that is Venus Optics had teased a lens a while ago that had a very unusual shape. Looks kind of like a drinking straw almost, which is a strange format for a lens. This is the Laowa 24mm 2x macro probe lens with an aperture of maximum aperture of f14, which kind of limits some usability. But I'm sure you've taken a look at this lens, and you might have taken a look at the Kickstarter campaign, which they are well overfunded. They're over $800,000 Canadian right now, and that number, since we started recording, ticked up by about $4,000, and it keeps growing. And most of the demos that they show with this lens, the most impressive ones anyhow, are the ones that reveal the possibilities for video and what this could mean for the cinema world. What's your take on this kind of equipment?
Well, in general, I don't go in for gimmicks. And this, to me, is clearly not a gimmick. This looks awesome. I mean, first of all, it's macro, but it's not macro.
Yeah, so it'll go to infinity focus on one side at 24 millimeters. So that's a relatively wide angle. And then it goes all the way up to 2:1 magnification. So twice the magnification as a regular macro lens. And if you could sort of pull focus from something in the distance all the way up to something super close, that could be a really fun reveal for like a CSI type program where you zoom in like from a crime scene all the way into one very specific piece of evidence. And while you can't do that every time, it's a wonderful tool, I guess, to have in your kit.
It is. And part of what, I mean, it's pretty amazing for what you can do. First of all, why isn't it called, shouldn't it be called the aardvark or the anteater?
I like that better than probe. But maybe they mean that because the long skinny barrel portion of the lens is completely waterproof as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not just water resistant. In a lot of their videos, they're dunking it in water and they're doing underwater photography where the camera's above water, but this lengthy probe that, I don't know, it looks like it's 12 inches long, that probe portion of it, mm-hmm. Is often submerged or dangerously close to water without anybody caring.
That looks amazing. Like the things that you can do with that. I watched a video of him, you know, shooting stuff in the stream or whatever, or the lake or whatever it was. Those possibilities are just amazing. The fact that you can get you can essentially stick the camera wherever you like is also fantastic. A lot of times you're hindered by, let's say you want to do like a small tracking shot. Well, you have to have track or handhold it or whatever it is. Well, this you can stick out over top of what you want to shoot. It gets right in there.
Well, and because the barrel is so small, it looks like it's like the size of a quarter, maybe a loonie. I mean, like it's very, very narrow. So in some of their examples, they're like throwing it right into like a bottle of some sort of orange pop, and it's right. Going right inside of it as if the entire camera is going inside, but you've got enough room with this, you know, sort of this 12 inch sort of probe to do things that previously wouldn't have really been that possible.
And so when I first saw this, my first thought was, what's David Fincher going to do with this?
Well, I mean, what am I going to do with it? I backed this thing immediately. In fact, I was worried because they had showed a prototype of this lens, must have been 2 years ago, and then they went quiet on it. And I was thinking, you know what? That concept, that really obscure niche of a lens, maybe they just won't get enough traction. It won't go beyond the prototype stage, and I'm not going to see it again. So I contacted Venus Optics at one point, never heard back from them, which, again, didn't bode well for this lens coming to market. And I was so happy when I got an email from Steve Brazel, another friend of the show, with the link to the Kickstarter campaign. So I was able to get in at one of the early bird prices. And I've just got some great ideas for this. But I also have had my hands on another lens. They're saying that this is revolutionary, and in many ways it is. There's a light built right into the end of the barrel, the fact that it's waterproof, and that it's generally accessible at a lower price point. It's still not the first lens of this type to be designed. I've had my hands on the Infinity Optical, which is a lesser known company than Venus Optics. They make the InfiniProbe TS-160, which can do something very similar, except sort of on steroids. It'll go to infinity focus, just like mm-hmm. this lens, but its closest focusing distance and magnification is 16 times. So imagine that as a range. You know, I can be photographing a beautiful winter landscape with snow falling and then pull focus and fill the frame with a snowflake. Mm-hmm. And that is interesting to me. It costs a lot more. I mean, it's between 3,000 and they've got a version that's closer to 5,000 US. So it's this is not new. This technology hasn't really matured beyond that one other example. And this is a much more consumer-facing product at a much lower price point. And by the looks of it, now looking at the optical formula, it's not a compound microscope, which the TS-160 is. Okay. Do you know why that's important?
I do not.
A compound microscope means that you've got basically two separate distinct optical systems. Mm-hmm. So when one optical system is in play, it refracts, the image flips upside down. And so the other one will flip it back upside right. And then on your viewfinder, that will also flip it back upside down. So if you have a compound microscope attached to a camera, everything is upside down and backwards.
Okay.
And that makes it sort of like a view camera in terms of composition and everything. But it's somewhat nauseating if you're trying to do that with video.
Sure. I can imagine that. Yeah. Any camera moves are going to be very counterintuitive.
Yeah, and I found that even if I had the camera locked down and I was moving the subject around for framing, you have to mentally train yourself to do the opposite motion as to what you're seeing on the screen.
Right. I think Da Vinci would have had no problem, but the rest of us are in trouble. The thing I liked about what I thought was pretty amazing is the not amazing but handy would be the LED light. It has a ring light around the lens, very very small.
And by all definition, in the video that we're seeing, it's really bright, yes. Which is perfect for cinema. And I use the ring flash on all of my lenses, my macro lenses. It's a favorite of mine, but it's not a constant, continuous light. And so for video purposes, this would be awesome. Question about it, though. It looks like there's a little sort of rectangle on the barrel of the lens. My guess is that that's where the battery is.
I found what that's for.
What is that?
That is where you plug in the cord that goes to the battery.
Okay, so the battery is a separate component?
That is unclear. It's a separate component. Whether or not you supply it or not, I don't know. They have not made that clear. I had thought from the footage I had seen online in the literature, it appeared to me, they not claimed it, but it appeared to me that it was going to be LED would be powered off the camera. Which I thought
that would be really difficult to do.
I just assumed like they hadn't made that claim. That was me making a leap. I was thinking, oh, that would be handy.
It would be, but I'm looking at the lens mount, and there's no electrical contacts as you would. It's a manual lens. You're controlling focus and aperture manually. Right. So to interface just power, I mean, yeah, the lens has to pull power from the camera to change autofocus on any lens automatically and to control the aperture and what have you. That's not impossible. But to have just a connection to the camera solely for the purposes of power, that seems odd.
But if they can build an invisible camera...
They can do anything.
Mm-hmm. That was my one concern is that, okay, now you know, you have to, it's not really a concern. It seems reasonable that you would have to power that light somehow. I just hadn't seen anything. They hadn't advertised it.
And if it's the standard, like plug-in for the external battery packs for flashes that would attach to a speed light, which I have some of those already that power 8 AA batteries, well, wouldn't that be convenient? However, in the one image that I'm looking at, it looks like a proprietary type of connector or something that might be like a USB-C adapter. And they've got those chargers for cell phones that you can plug in there. And so those power sources exist and they're readily available and they're not expensive. But I'd rather, you know, use the gear I already have.
Sure. Yeah. And my other concern about this, not even concern, but consideration is a lens this long, any little bit of camera shake, even at 24 millimeters, the equivalent, is likely to be magnified.
Exactly. And if you're trying to pull focus and you've got some sort of, you know, gear system attached to the lens, you know, those mechanized automatic focus adjustment dealies, which I might have to buy if I want to use this for some of that cinema work. I would have to make sure I get one that is really smooth. Maybe something specifically designed to the grooves on this lens barrel to remove any potential motion or shake that it would introduce.
Mm-hmm. Because the focus, as you can see in the pictures, the focus ring is near the camera.
Yeah.
Which means if it was up front, you'd be able to somewhat steady yourself and thus hopefully not amplify the camera shake. It's going to make it much, much worse at the back.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at their optical design, it's a crazy lens because it's got, 27 lens elements in 19 groups.
Right.
I've never seen a lens with that many elements, at least not in this design, but most of them are in that that barrel that are kind of keeping the light collimated to a certain degree, because it's got a long way to go before the optics start spreading the light out to make a viable image on the sensor itself. And so that's just all like filled with glass, that entire tube, which might make it a little heavy and lopsided too, if you think about it. That the front barrel that is very narrow will be much heavier than the rest of the lens.
That's a good point. Hey, they must have considered balancing it out to use for video, because the video I've seen does look fantastic.
It does. And so the proof is in the pudding, I suppose. And I'm looking forward to getting this later this year. And I'll be putting it to work. They don't have a Micro Four Thirds lens mount, which I'm shooting more often with now. But I'll get it in a Canon mount, adapt it. I've got the adapters for that. And I've got some really fun ideas. This will go 2-to-1 magnification, which on Micro Four Thirds is the equivalent of 4-to-1 on my full frame cameras. And so for video purposes, if I were to be shooting outside winter snowflakes and stuff like that, the really big magical sort of dendrite crystals, they will fill the frame at that size. And I'd be able to pull focus from something in the distance. So wouldn't it be cool to pull focus from like a freezing soap bubble 2 feet back and then fold that into a snowflake right in front of that with all the lighting and everything staged? That could be something that would work really nicely in a documentary film. So the ideas are already running through my head with a lens like this. And
I'm looking forward to seeing them.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to, as soon as you get something like this in your hands, I mean, at least for me, and you start experimenting, many new ideas just pop up. So
I think the challenge will be coming up with an interesting story, because you're going to get stopped in the street a lot.
You don't want to use this lens in public, because it looks like the barrel of a gun.
Yeah,
and enough photographers are already getting shot or arrested because
the
telephoto lens looks like a gun on a tripod to some people in law enforcement.
Valid point.
Yeah. Oh, so no. 2 feet from my back door, I'm more than happy to tinker around with something like this or in my studio, but a public appearance, I don't know, this might stay at home.
Good call. Never even thought of that.
Right. Speaking about public appearances, that's the terrible segue to the next story. But there is a farm, a sunflower farm, very near to me, actually, in Hamilton, Ontario. That's maybe an hour's drive away. And for years, they've opened up their farm to the public to wander around the sunflowers and take pictures and just enjoy the beauty of the sunflowers at their prime. And they've been doing it for a number of years. They'll, get, maybe 1,000 people go through in the season or what have you. They had to close because they became Instagram famous when some, I'm guessing, notable, the quote unquote influencers on Instagram posted photographs, geotagged or writing their exact location of this farm. And they were just ridiculously overwhelmed. Estimates put the cars at the site around 7,000 at a time. Their parking lot fits 100 people. So people are probably parking in places where they shouldn't, crossing busy roads or, just entering in from vectors that were not passing through and paying money. Because they were, charging $7.50 an adult. And if you have 7,000 vehicles, and I'm assuming that means that there's maybe more than 10,000 people attending, because not every vehicle is going to have one person, then you have 10,000 people at a time trying to take a selfie with sunflowers. Is this right. What the world has come to?
Well, I this was confusing to me to see. We have sunflowers everywhere here. Never mind. Forget I said that.
The crowds are going to go to you.
Don't come here. It was confusing to me. I get the allure of the sunflower. They very, very, very beautiful. Why these specific sunflowers, I don't know.
Because they're close to an urban body, right? It's close to the the Greater Toronto Area, which has a population in the millions. And so if you have people that want to photograph those sunflowers, then that's a quick drive. You know, I've pulled over on the roadside in rural Bulgaria and did some selfies with sunflowers years ago with my wife and father-in-law. And it was fun, you know.
How many thousands of people were there, though?
I think we were the only person that would ever stop at that particular sunflower field to pose. I'm sure other people will try to steal some of the sunflower seeds because that's the kind of culture that that they have there. But no, I mean, we're the only people. And same for you. I mean, you said you've got sunflower fields everywhere. We've got sunflower fields just outside of Barrie, which is, again, like maybe an hour drive from the GTA. They were not swarmed with people. But because the location was made famous by one or two or however many Instagrammers, then that caused such a public reaction. I did not know Instagram was that powerful in the real world.
Yes, that was confusing to me. Like for example, if my wife said to me, "Hey, we're gonna drive out to a sunflower field, and it's gonna cost you $7," first response, no. second response, if she insists and we go out there, and they have room for 100 cars, and we're car number 101, we're leaving. That's what's happening.
Yeah, you're not going to sit there waiting for a car to leave, driving around looking for a spot. It's like, okay, this place is packed. It's not going to be an enjoyable experience. I hate searching for a parking spot in the malls at Christmas time. This sounds exactly like that. No, it's not happening.
However, so now here's the part. This is all very, like I said, very confusing. I don't understand first of all, do yourself a favor, everybody, and knock off the selfies in general. not full stop. The occasional selfie is reasonable. You know, I look back at some of the images I shot long before selfie cameras, before the iPhones, before the front facing camera. You know, you would do the old kind of hold the camera up and snap a shot.
If you're on the Great Wall of China, you are allowed to take one selfie. If you're in front of the Eiffel Tower, I would say you're allowed to take one selfie.
I disagree because honestly, have somebody take a picture of you.
True enough.
Do that, make friends with people, like on a cultural level. Like on the one hand, it's amazing. Instagram is amazing because 7,000 or 10,000 people showed up for one common cause.
That was just at once. Throughout the day, I'm sure that number, the full number of cars is well into maybe 20,000. They don't share the numbers exactly, but all for taking photos of yourself with sunflowers.
So. But it's a bunch of like-minded people. So in that regard, I'm trying to not be a snob on this because I like being places. Like there's certain places when we go and travel around Europe, like for example, if I'm in Munich, there's a certain spot where you can go and stand, and that's where Hitler was arrested. Excuse me. That's where Hitler was arrested. You know, I forget the exact year, but before he was thrown in jail and wrote Mein Kampf, for example. Now, not a big fan of his work, but history happened right there. And so for me, I've seen I've seen a photo of that rally and think, oh my God, this happened right here. So, or when you're at the Berlin Wall, at Checkpoint Charlie, and all these different places, you can go to Normandy, all World War II related for me. But so I get it. I understand being somewhere.
I want to try and get access to the former Communist Party headquarters during the era of the Soviet Union in Bulgaria. Again, I've been there twice through less than legitimate access. Urban exploration is something that I enjoy on occasion, but I want to get legitimate access to that building again when we travel there later this month, have like some sort of official. And I don't mind paying. I mean, they're trying to restore this particular building, and that history, as much as I don't agree with it, should not be forgotten. You know, it is important, and so these places and these events are worth remembering and being there to document, right?
So that's why I don't want to be a snob, because just because I happen to like World War II history and these 10,000 people on this one day like Instagram selfie history, that's okay. I can get past that. So it is a bunch of like-minded people coming together. The issue being, you're not taking pictures of each other. You're taking selfies, which makes it a little bit weird. I'm not being dismissive of that. The part that really does bug me is that from what the story I read, very few people were actually paying to go on there.
Exactly. Because if the parking lot only fits 100 cars and you have to kind of go through the parking lot to the to pay, then that means a very, very small fraction of these people were paying the venue. And I completely disagree with that. I mean, if you're going to be trampling over their crops, I mean, they make a little bit of money from these people walking through, but this is a crop of sunflowers for them to sell the seeds. Yes. And they've got 1.4 million sunflowers. And so if you trample through their crops, and I can guarantee you that this was, you know, the damage was done, that they're not going to recoup on that. So interesting bit of social behavior to study for something like this, though. And I like to get sort of under the hood of the technical aspects of photography. And this is sort of the social aspect of it. And it's just interesting to see sociology at play with photography being a core element.
On the flip side, so sociologically speaking, the sunflower fields here, they sell them. The flowers are for sale. You cut them yourself. And, oh, cool. And there's just a metal, like a metal piggy bank by the sign where you put your money in. So they tell you whatever it is. I honestly don't know. It's like 5 euros or 3 euros for a sunflower, whatever it is.
And it's on the honor system. We do the same thing with Christmas trees here. You know, there's an empty lot that's just filled with Christmas trees, and there's nobody there tending to it. There's just a box saying how much it costs for a tree. You put your money in the box, you take your tree, and off you go.
There you go. So it can happen.
It can. It can. Now, how many people actually just walk away with a tree without paying? I don't know. But I can tell you, in Eastern Europe, again, in Bulgaria, that would never fly. You know, you leave anything of value out, it will disappear when you turn your back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyhow. So there we go. Sociology and photography meet in a sunflower field. I don't think there's much more to talk about on that topic. But there is some fun, you know, interesting stories that I found to wind off this episode. One that I thought was really interesting, Alireza Rostami of Iran has been experimenting with mucking around with lenses and taking them apart and putting them back together. And he came across a vintage lens. It was the from Zenit, the MC Zenitar 50mm f2 lens that you can find on eBay for around $20. And as soon as I read this article, cha-ching, somebody in the Ukraine has my money and is shipping me a lens to do a... well, let's hope so. The last one I ordered from the Ukraine did arrive for a modification of the lens in a similar way, actually. This creates a really interesting bokeh effect. When you get out-of-focus specular highlights, which are relatively easy to do, I've got a bunch of mineral samples that can create that, interestingly enough, or raindrops on something that are lit from the right angle. When those go out-of-focus, they create bokeh. And if you have a lens, like I also own a Trioplan 100, which is known for its soap bubble bokeh, a very expensive lens that Meyer Optic is currently selling. I think it was for $1,600 US. This reminds me of that effect. In fact, in some ways, it can be even more beautiful. What do you think about these sort of bokeh monster lenses? And how do you feel about taking a lens apart and putting it back together in order to create the effect?
I saw these images. I read this last week, I guess. They look amazing. They look really, really cool. Like I said, like the whole dreamy imagery. Really fantastic. Now, what did he physically do? Did he describe it?
Yeah, so there is a video that shows him taking it apart and putting it back together. He didn't take the front or the rear element off and put it back together, which I've done with the Mir 1B lens that can be had for around $40 on eBay. On mine, the front element just unscrews, and I can just, you know, by hand, unscrew it, put it on backwards, and I get this kind of almost a zoomish effect, like the edges kind of pull away in terms of the bokeh. But in this case, he took a lens cluster, a lens grouping inside the lens, and flipped it around backwards in the middle of the lens itself. And so he does show a video. He doesn't talk through the video, which makes it hard to understand exactly what he's doing. But I saw some videos that, animations that show exactly what lens group is reversed. And it shouldn't be hard with a jeweler screwdriver to take the lens apart, find that element, and put it back in, following the video for reference. It seems like you could probably do it in about 10 minutes if you're at all familiar with taking things apart. And I, for one, am. So I think it'll be a fun experiment. And I wouldn't want a full portfolio of work using this stuff. Right. But for the occasional fun trick shot where the the mood suits you, or even for video, if that bokeh could be moving or changing over video, it could add a little bit of extra atmosphere to a specific shot or a certain flavor. If you are looking for a dream sequence or something, this would definitely hit that mark.
The question becomes, is it worth it to go to this length? I say yes, it is.
Absolutely. $70 and 10 minutes of my time. I did spend that $1,600 on that Meyer Optic Trioplan 100 new version of their lens because I liked the effect. And I have sold images taken with that lens because of the effect. I don't know if it's necessarily paid for itself yet at this point, but it will be in my camera bag forever. So at some point, I'll hit that break-even point. I will hit the break-even point almost instantly with this $70 investment. Will it be useful in every scenario? No, it's like a fisheye lens. It's great to have. It's relatively compact. Once in a while, I'll use it for astrophotography or for some architectural work, but it's not going to come out for portraits. I did use it for macro once, but it has a very limited use case. But for $70, by all means, it's going to sit in my camera bag and live there until I come across that scene where it is useful.
See, I have a philosophy. One of my many philosophies in life is that hard work is never wasted. So if you just want to buy one of these and take it apart and then never shoot an image with it, that would be a shame. But the knowledge you will gain from taking a lens apart and putting it back together is worth the effort.
Even if you fail, like even if you can't remember how you took it apart and there's screws left over and it just doesn't work for you, you've learned something in the process, let's hope.
And so taking it apart, that's the easy part. You can all
exactly.
Do that.
Well, when I was young, my dad was an electronics repair technician. And oftentimes when a VCR came in to the shop, it would cost more to fix than it would be to buy a new one.
Right.
So he would say, here you go. Here's a VCR to take apart. And as like an 8-year-old child with a screwdriver, with no intention of ever putting that thing back together, it was heaven.
I did a lot of that myself, not specifically with VCRs, but all kinds of stuff. And the knowledge you gain from that, well worth it. So anyone thinking about this, do it. And hopefully we'll get inundated with these bokeh images, but that's okay. They look pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, most people aren't going to take these with their iPhone.
Well, exactly. And there might be some software that could add that as a filter. You know what? I like to do it in camera. The more magic done in camera, the better. And I had looked on eBay for this lens after this has already, I'm going to say, gone viral, but had been featured on a number of photo blogs and had a large enough audience. I was still able to find one for $70. So there are a lot of these out there, and people are enjoying the images. If you are listening to this podcast, go out and buy one of these MC Zenitar 50mm F2 lenses. It's an M42 mount, so that's a Leica screw mount. And there are adapters for that for every camera system under the sun. And those adapters cost like $5.
So get one and go out and take pictures of sunflowers.
Yes, absolutely. Good segue tying that together. But if you don't feel inventive on the hardware side, you don't want to take stuff apart. I mean, there's a company that's been active in allowing you to mess with selective focus for quite some time, and that's Lens Baby. And that brings us into our final story. The Lens Baby Sol. S-O-L. I guess that's for sun. This is a new lens that they've just announced. And it has, they've been playing around with unusual apertures, lenses with double apertures or, tilt shift designs. This one looks a bit unusual. It has aperture blades that snap into place that, I don't know, they look like, weirdly shaped green beans or peanuts that kind of cover the lens in order to produce some interesting soft focus effects. Cool, I think. What do you think about this, Alan?
Well, I'm looking at this and wondering why have I never shot with a Lens Baby? This looks like fun to me.
It is. I own the Lens Baby Suite 50. It's fun to just kind of take out and experiment with, because it'll give you a little blob of focus and everything kind of falls off of focus around it. They've got their edge optics, which function more like a tilt shift lens. Their Burns Head optics, which, if I remember correctly, has two aperture blades inside the same lens, both that can be pivoted around each other for some crazy effects. And this kind of continues along within that series. There's two lenses, a 22 millimeter and a 45 millimeter lens. And it just plays with messing around with light, almost like pinhole optics. You could get pinholes that are not just a solid circle. You can get them that are like a sieve, that have a whole different pattern of different dots that all connect together to make an image. And so it reminds me of that in a way, where you are kind of creating multiple, non-circular apertures that the light has to pass through just to bend it and twist it in a way that we might find beautiful.
It does look like a lot of fun. I mean, it might be similar to the last last lens you were just talking about, in that
it's not unreasonable in price, right? Well, yeah. I mean, if you're walking through a botanical garden, this might be a great lens to have if you're getting up close to flowers and mucking about, or if you want to do something different in terms of street photography, you might spend a few hours shooting with something like this. It's $199.95 US. And that, in terms of the cost of a new lens, that's pretty reasonable for new equipment with a specific effect in mind. It's three times the cost of that lens we were just talking about if you wanted to modify it yourself for some creative effect. But it's still in the very approachable photographic equipment realm, where you want to play with light. You want to just mess it up a little bit, where optics don't need to be pristine to be beautiful. Then $200 is not a difficult entry point to get into.
No, I think this is something I'm going to look at. Maybe not this Lens Baby. I'm going to look at picking up a Lens Baby, though, because it does look like a lot of fun. A bunch of the criticisms I quickly saw online, as the internet does when I was researching this, was a lot of hipster references. Is this for hipsters? And do we still have hipsters, first of all?
Well, yes. If you are a hipster, you will probably like this lens. But I think it grows beyond that.
I would also say that this doesn't seem like just a hipster thing. It does look a lot like some of the filters that you could see online, like that you would add to your iPhone. But I don't know. I have to give this one a thumbs up.
Here's a trick that I have in mind that might actually even be applicable to a lens like this. But you can make your own aperture, right? You can. Right. And there's a concept that I've had for a while, and I just haven't had a chance to execute it. And it's maybe I should do like a Kickstarter campaign for this. Maybe somebody will beat me to it. But go out and buy yourself a lens cap, one of the generic ones on eBay that just have like the fake leather pattern or whatever it is. And you're going to cut out the center of that. So this is just something that will easily clip on the front of your lens. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have a little holder that maybe you can manufacture. It's kind of like the holders that they have for rear gel filters on certain wide angle lenses that you can just slide something into. Okay. Then go out and buy yourself some inkjet printable clear acetate sheets. These are designed for displaying on overhead projectors. So you can print on something clear. So then you can print an aperture of any shape or design. It can be complex. It can have internal elements that you wouldn't be able to just cut out of a piece of paper that you could then slide into this little holder. Now you have a bokeh of your own creation, and you can print any aperture that you want.
That's the next level stuff that we talked about that offline like a year ago, because we talked.
Yeah. So, you know, I've had this idea for a long time, and I've done nothing with it.
Oh, I thought you implemented it. Okay, well, don't publish this part. I don't want someone stealing that, because that was the game changer for me, because it is the kind of fun, you know, like every second Christmas time, you know, we'll throw that together. We'll talk about it on the two hosers. We'll you know, get the piece of black cardboard, an X-Acto knife, and you cut out a star, and then the bokeh becomes a star, and everybody's impressed for about half a second. But it's a lot of work. And then you described the acetate printing, and I thought, well, that's game on now. I mean, you want to have your, in theory, I mean, you want to have your watermark as bokeh? Done.
Yeah. Or you want to use a black and white version of a photograph as your aperture. So like you want to take a photo of a tree and then invert it so that the tree is where the transparency comes through. And now that tree becomes your bokeh, right?
Okay, you just blew my mind. Yes. There's a lot. Now, again, it can stray into the gimmicky area, which I previously said I don't care for.
But that's what Kickstarter's all about.
But this one's fun. This one is a lot of fun you can have. Again, really just Christmas. It's all about Christmas time.
Yeah. Well, I've had an idea that if I can do, I don't know if modifying the optics of my soap bubble bokeh lens will function well with this, but wouldn't it be cool if I could create a square aperture? And then have the soap bubble bokeh still exist in a square and then shoot like a bunch of grass or like some sort of natural flower covered in dew and have all of the bokeh turn into interesting squares in the background. One trick pony. I get to do that once. I can't do that for a series of images, but it would be a fun one to do.
Indeed. Okay. I look forward to that. You got your work cut out for you, Don.
I do. I have way too many fun ideas and never enough time. You know, my daughter is just over two now, and she is there's a reason why they call it the terrible twos. We balance that out with all of the joy and the supreme cuteness that makes up for it. But there are some moments, I tell you, and I know you've been through it.
I have. I wasn't going to give advice, but turns out two it should be called the terrible threes, relatively speaking.
Yeah. Or somebody said to me, you know, they call it the terrible twos because it lasts for 2 years.
There you go. That is very accurate. However, you must have a lot of good photos, a lot of good stuff. So it definitely outweighs on this side. If that was the case, people wouldn't have more than one kid.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, we won't go too far down that rabbit hole as we're reaching sort of the end of this episode. But before the end, we have some picks of the week. And since our headlining story was the new Laowa 24mm lens, I wanted to cement it as a pick that Infinity Optical exists as a company. They are obscure. You won't find their hardware on B&H or anywhere else. They might have some distributors. You can probably order it directly from them. The InfiniProbe TS160 goes from infinity focus to 16 times magnification. I borrowed the lens to test it out at one point, and it lives up to the expectations. It can do what it claims. It is a bit tricky to use because it's they have one that's a regular macro optic that doesn't get that extreme magnification, and that comes with the lens as well. But the high magnification 16 times optic is a compound microscope scenario, so you're going to see things upside down on the back of the viewfinder. But all you have to do is flip your video or your image in post, and then you get back to reality. So that is my pick. Just under $3,000 US for their basic model. They have an advanced one that has aspherical lens elements that they say is designed more for the higher end cinema personnel, and that's $4,500 US. If you want to get into this realm of a higher magnification than macro and you've got some crazy ideas that work well at 2x, then you can, you know, take this extra step. If it's worth the shot to do an opening sequence to a documentary or something, then it will cover its expenses right away. So that is my pick of the week. Alan, what do you got?
I tied mine in with the lens baby for the hipsters. I double check, it will shoot on a full frame. So if you don't have a full frame camera, maybe you've always wanted to get one. I highly recommend the Canon 5D Classic.
That was the first full frame camera that I owned. And I echo that recommendation. It's a wonderful piece of equipment, 12 megapixels, if memory serves.
I think so. Yeah.
And because of its vintage nature, it's well over a decade old now. You can find them.
Yeah. 13 years now, I think.
13 years, and you can find them in the used market for, what do you say you were looking for one for?
No, I've had one for a number of years.
No, but in terms of price, you'd looked and you saw them going about $300
or so. I think if you do your homework, you can get it for under $300. So you look $200 to $250. You can, sometimes some people, once they hear this show, of course, that price will go up. If you're to spend $400, you're still getting your money's worth. I love, this is my favorite camera. I have three of the four 5D marks, and this one being the classic, the Mark One, technically.
Now, it doesn't shoot video, so that's a caveat. But
There's
no live view. But what if you were setting up one camera to do like a time-lapse sequence of something? You could easily control this. Canon has their own intervalometer, but Velo and Young Nuo and a lot of other manufacturers make very cheap intervalometers. It would be fun, even just as a secondary camera, throw another cheap lens on it just to shoot that time-lapse from a different angle to cut together for video, if you're looking for a backup camera. Or if you want to just play, 12 megapixels is still a lot. And yes, the high ISO performance isn't there, but if you want to just muck about with one of these lens babies or any other cheap optic and just have some fun on a full-frame camera, that's a great recommendation.
The LCD screen is terrible. These are a couple more things I would like to point out, that the battery life is also awful. However, it is my favorite camera. It stays out of your way. There's no video to get in the way. There's no, again, the live view doesn't get in your way. There's nothing to learn. It is actually, it takes photographs.
There was only three or five autofocus points, if I remember correctly.
I only ever used the one in the middle anyways.
Right.
So like I have the 85 millimeter F1.8 lens that just lives on that camera. And I take this thing everywhere. I actually bought mine for a couple hundred euros a few years ago. So I've had it for probably 5 years now, taking a lot of images with it. And one of the big rubs was earlier when I said I was looking at the Sony, I wanted maybe the Sony a7 III. I was not in love with the photos it was taking. Like, they're very amazing, crisp, really, really beautiful digital images.
Digital images. That's a key statement right there.
And the classic is digital, but the images, they look like photographs. And it's a hard thing to describe without sounding like one of those previously mentioned hipsters, but I love it. So I don't know what it is. The high ISO capability is lousy.
Well, it's like explaining the value of a medium format camera to somebody that just went out and bought a 50 megapixel 5DSR or something. I mean, right. It's a different feel. Yes, the resolution might be the same, but the resulting images have a difference that is hard to describe in common words.
Right. And lastly, the menus are terrible. So Canon really, they did a great job upgrading. So the jump from the 5D to the 5D2 was a massive jump.
Yeah.
From 2 to 3, I'm loving it. There's a lot going on there. It's great. 3 to 4, it's a little bit, not exactly a quantum leap, but if you are looking for it to have fun, I highly, highly recommend it. You will love the images you get.
Yeah. And, you know, to echo that statement too, I do a lot of echoing in this podcast, but I upgraded from the 1DX to the 1DX Mark II because the 1DX Mark II shot 4K video. That was the only reason.
Right.
And I knew that I needed that for some upcoming projects. Now I'm shooting with a GX9, a Lumix GX9 and a GH5. Both of them do 4K video. And the GH5 does 4K video better than my 1DX Mark II does. Okay. At a fraction of the price. So,
right.
You know, for that reason, I just needed one feature for that upgrade. I did not care that the autofocus system was better. I never use autofocus on that camera. So like you buying the 5D Mark III, that's the perfect camera for you. If somebody does not have a full frame camera and they want to spend a couple of $100 on the next photographic toy, the 5D Classic is where you'll find it.
And at that price, now, it's not like I can afford to just throw $300 down the toilet. However, it's at the price point where I will take that camera anywhere and everywhere. If I go to the beach and I leave and I'm going to want to go swimming, I will kind of flip it under my shirt or under a towel so no one walks off with it. But if someone steals it, I'm not going to be that upset.
And it's a camera that if you are trying to do something risky, like you're trying to photograph like a rocket launch up close, mm-hmm. Well, you might be able to sacrifice the camera. You'll put protection measures in place, but if the camera does take its last picture during that, well, then maybe that was just the cost of taking that particular picture.
It's like a Ferrari owner having a daily drive. Of course, he's got a Mazda to drive around every day.
Right, right. But, you know, to be honest, if I owned a Ferrari, I would take it to the grocery store.
Well, valid point.
All right, Alan, where can people find you? I mean, you've got your podcast, The Two Hosers Photo Show.
Yes. That's at twohosers.com.
Twohosers.com. And the number two or the word two?
TWOHosers.com. And there's a new show every Monday morning. We have not
fantastic.
Missed
it. And that is with your host, your co-host, Adam Schwartz. Great guy. And you actually started the podcast because Adam was just learning photography and it was a venue for you to teach him and everybody else could learn through that. And he's grown quite a bit as a photographer over the years.
He actually earns money as a photographer now. From day one, he got a DSLR about 8 years ago and said, "Hey man, like, how do I open this box?" That's all he knew. He didn't know how to do anything. And I said, "Well, rather than tell you, we'll record a podcast every week and I'll show you something new. And then the listeners can basically, you know, learn along with you." And that's kind of what happened. So if you go all the way back, I think you can find episode one and listen all the way through. And people have, believe it or not, I get contacted every once in a while where someone says, "Hey, I was driving cross country. We listened to all 396 episodes in a row."
Wow.
Yeah, that's mind blowing.
That's diehard. That's fantastic. But that just proves that the content that you generate and the banter back and forth, aside from the photographic stuff, it feels like you're in the room chatting with two great guys. And photography is the topic that always kind of syncs everything together.
Well, in September, you'll be one of those guys again. We're spoiler alert. We've recorded all our August episodes because of holidays.
I'm envious of that. That, you know, there's gaps in Photo Geek Weekly. Like, I didn't do an episode last week because I was doing a big art show. And so that took up all of my time prepping for the show. And I'm the most exhausting weekend ever. It's a profitable show. It's the only one that I do here in Barrie, the Kempenfest weekend, the August long weekend. But couldn't do a show last week because there was just too many other things going on. And I can't record them in advance because it's kind of based on the news of the week. Right. So uh, you, you